All right, ladies and gentlemen, today is May 14, 2014, and you are attending an agenda of the Board of Public Works. So if that's why you're here, you're in the right place. We have a couple of distinguished individuals to honor right off the start. One is my neighbor, Robert Marchanti, and his wife Peggy is here, and his son Jonah, and also Leah. And so Major Marchanti gave his life for all of us in the line of duty in Afghanistan. And we also have, we're going to be honoring Senator Wagner, who had served as a state senator here in the Maryland State Senate, and his family are here today as well. So, any opening thoughts, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer?
Thank you, Governor, and I'm looking forward to the two events you just mentioned. But I would like to just mention, in addition to that, that we're going to, on today's agenda, give final approval to the state's school construction program for fiscal year 2015. And frankly, the incredibly challenging winter that we had, it's just recently that we've started to actually feel like spring, and we're a little bit removed from our memories, but it was a really bad winter. As you recall, I've given enormous credit to Secretary of Transportation, Jim Smith, for his team for dealing with the streets and the inclement weather and now all the potholes and all that. But I'd like to take advantage of today to just recognize another group, which is our state teachers. And think of all the rearranging of lesson plans that teachers in our schools did to ensure that our kids received the instruction with all of the interruptions from the bad weather. How about the maintenance workers in the schools who worked above and beyond to make sure that the facilities could respond to the adverse weather conditions? And bus drivers who safely got our children to and from school, often amid tough road conditions and shifting bus stops. And last but not least, administrators who take a lot of criticism at the system because of all their high-ranking responsibilities, but they're the folks who had to make the tough choices about how to get the logistics of the weather and the school schedule together, and it was, I'm sure, a nightmare for them. So it's been a challenging year for our schools. I believe everyone in the system responded to the weather. Serves as a reminder of the resilience of our nation's top public schools and the personnel behind the scenes. So I just wanted to take a moment and give them a little bit of recognition. They are obviously critical not to just our kids' education, but also the state's economic future. And speaking of Maryland's economic future, yesterday Britt Kerwin announced that he will be retiring as chancellor of the University System of Maryland. Here's an individual who's been a professor, a university president, now chancellor, a leader in higher education for nearly five decades. Under his presidency, College Park shot up the rankings, right up to becoming one of the nation's finest public universities. And the entire system, with Britt as chancellor, has developed a reputation for Maryland that is well known around the country, even amid obviously challenging times where the affordability and accessibility of higher education has gone back and forth. But Britt's biggest legacy to the state of Maryland will be his recognition of how connected the university system is to the state's economy. He served on the boards of the Maryland Chamber of Commerce, the Greater Baltimore Committee, the Economic Alliance of Greater Baltimore, the Maryland Business Roundtable for Education. He's cognizant of the crucial relationship between our state, our universities, and the business community. I'm particularly appreciative of his emphasis on innovation and entrepreneurship. We're going to miss his visionary leadership. He's certainly not being pushed out. He's leaving on his own. He says it's time to pass the baton. But I think we're going to be seeing down the road, despite missing him, we're going to see the social and economic dividends of his long and successful career for many, many years to come. And so I'll be thinking of him as we vote on the school construction budget.
Thank you.
There's not much more one can say about Britt, and yet there's so much more one could say about Britt. He's been a fixture in Annapolis since he came as an assistant professor of mathematics from Rutgers, I think, 50 years ago, which is a while. And during that time, absolutely not. I think, and you can correct me, that Britt Kernwin is the only man who is both president of College Park and chancellor of the University System of Maryland. He helped bring the university to Shady Grove in Montgomery County, the model of regional higher education. He created the Honors College at the University of Maryland College Park, which has been extremely instrumental in enhancing the image of the undergraduate program there while continuing to build a university that was well known for athletics and agriculture and physics, thanks to Johnny Toll, to one that is known for a multitude of disciplines. And while it's always good for folk to go off at the peak, at the top, I have no doubt that Britt will be around for quite a while advising and leading, both on a national level, but here in Maryland, too. It's hard to think. I am convinced I won one election in Bethesda because of a picture and quote from Britt Kernwin, so I have a personal obligation. But just a very great man to work with. And it shows, there was some doubt, Peter, actually, when he came back as chancellor, whether he could do the job, because Britt was so closely identified with College Park. And the question is, can you go from being so supportive of one campus to being the leader of the entire community? And clearly the answer is yes, you can, and Britt did it. I'd like to just also note for a moment the passing of, the actual passing of another great person in Maryland higher education. Over the weekend, Rhoda Dorsey passed away. Rhoda Dorsey was the first woman president of Goucher College and the woman who led the transformation of Goucher into a co-ed school. A move that some people opposed and doubted would succeed, and clearly has succeeded. A woman of just outstanding temperament, leadership. She was a lady, but a very forceful one at all times. In my recollection, when I was chairing some committees in the legislatures, the combination of Rhoda Dorsey and her chairman of the board, Walter Sondheim, was a team that simply couldn't be beat. It will surprise some people out there to know there was a time when there were only two or three women higher education leaders of institutions in Maryland. Rhoda, of course, Martha Church, and then Catherine Guerra and Rita Caldwell, and Marty Smith. And now it's grown, and women are taking a much stronger role, and I can't help but think that a lot of that was because of Rhoda Dorsey. So we note with great respect her role and her parting, and we note with anticipation waiting for Britt Kernwin's next role here. And with that, I thank you.
Thank you, Madam Treasurer. Oh, that is a segue. Speaking of strong women, let's the Marchanti family. What item is that? Is that DPS?
This is item 10 on the Secretary's agenda. Ms.
Item 10.
She's here from the Military Department to introduce the item, and she bring up the...
Peggy, guys want to come up?
Good morning, Governor O'Malley, Treasurer Kopp.
Leah.
Comptroller Francho, Catherine Kelly with the Maryland Military Department. At this time, I'd like to introduce the Joint Force Headquarters Chaplain, Colonel Lee, and he'll introduce our guests and present the item.
Good morning.
How are you, Chaplain?
Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, we have with us Peggy Marchanti, Major Robert Marchanti's wife, widow, Leah, daughter, Jonah, not to be confused with Ian, who's the other twin who's not here today, but Jonah. Also, Pauline, a French exchange student who's living with the family now, and Faith.
Sure.
Faith, who's the significant other for Jonah, and then Cindy Ryan from the Red Cross, who's with the family. For the Board of Public Works, my role is rather simple. It's you have the recommendation that we've made on behalf of Major General James Atkins, our Adjutant General from Maryland Military Department, that the gymnasium at Camp Frederick Military Reservation be renamed as the Major Robert J. Marchanti II Physical Fitness Center. Major Marchanti was a part of the Maryland Army National Guard. I also counted him as a friend and knew him for many, many years. He was killed on February 25th, 2012, in Kabul, Afghanistan, while deployed with the 29th Division's International Security Assistance Force. But Bob had deep roots in the community, too. He graduated from Towson University with his degree in physical education, was a PE teacher in Baltimore County Schools, and mentored and made a difference in many a young person's life, but he was also a physical fitness buff. He was a foreboding man, but yet a gentle giant, loved by us all, and we hope you'll grant our request to rename that gymnasium to honor his sacrifice, his service, and his commitment to the sons and daughters of Maryland who served in the Maryland Military Department, as well as the students he taught in school.
Peggy, any thoughts? Anything you want to say?
Just thank you for considering this and for everything that the governor's office has done. It's been wonderful and honoring, and it's really blessed our lives that, you know, everyone remembers him. As time goes on, it's true, less and less people remember, and so today was wonderful that you guys remember. So I hope it's a yes, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Kids? Yeah? No? Yes. No? Here we go.
I just wanted to say thank you again, too. I couldn't think of a better way to honor my father than to rename the gymnasium after him. I mean, he taught, what was it, 18 years? 17. He was a gym teacher for 17 years, and that's where he really touched the lives of a lot of people, even if you called him up or hit him up on Facebook, like, they'll tell you all about it. Some of them are married and have families, and they still remember my father's impact from, you know, what he did in a gymnasium. So I think renaming a gymnasium is probably something that would make him very, very happy if he was here to see it. So thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all for everything that your family's been called upon to do for us. Chaplain?
Governor, I'm not too versed at this, so I don't know what else to say.
So when you look like you have the votes, you should call the vote. So, Mr. Comptroller, moves approval. Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Aye. Unanimous. That never happens. Let's do this. If those assembled will indulge us, why not, Marchantes, why don't you all come around here, and we'll stand and we'll do a picture here underneath the watchful eye of George Calvert.
Thank you. So this is the gym at Camp Crescent.
Yes.
That's a good chance.
The next item is item 8, in honor of Senator Wagner. Who wants to speak to
that? Secretary Smith is recommending that the BWI hiker biker trail be named after Senator Wagner.
Comptroller, it's item 8 on the Secretary's agenda. It is an 11-mile hiker-biker trail that circles BWI Marshall, and it was a suggestion of Senator Ed DeGrange, and that suggestion was joined in by County Executive Laura Newman, and in fact Barbara Wilkins is here on her behalf, and I think I'm going to turn it over to the sponsor who was the momentum behind it, Senator Ed DeGrange. Senator?
Thank you. Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, this is a project that I'm absolutely proud to be able to recommend to the Secretary, and his great wisdom saw that this was a perfect fit for Senator Wagner, to recognize Senator Wagner. I have with me today Mrs. Wagner, Carol Wagner, Mike's wife, and his daughter-in-law, Liz Wagner, who also at one time was my legislative assistant. And the family's been a strong, strong family within that community for a long time. But Senator Wagner, as a representative for District 32, as the airport was expanding, saw the vision that the community needed to have something that they could have ownership to. And that's where he saw that this, having a bike trail around the airport, he saw the growth of the airport was a positive thing, as being a strong advocate for economic development, having his own business, raising his family within the community right next to the airport. But he also saw that the community needed to have some ownership and some nice things attached to it. And that bike trail was part of that whole process. So, as a business leader in the community, as a coach, sponsor of many, so many organizations that I can't even name, a friend to the families there, a personal friend of mine for many years, a mentor, and, of course, the family as well. And his legacy will continue to go on because he's going to continue to support many of the charities and so forth within that community. And I couldn't think of a better way to recognize someone that cared so much about their community than to have the naming of this bike trail around the airport in his honor.
Okay. Thoughts? Questions?
Just a great guy. He would always avoid this kind of recognition, but super person. And love what the family said at his memorial. But I do have a complaint. My assistant was at Mikey's on the weekend having breakfast with his
friends. Will have spam.
Yeah, no, they apparently okay. It was
on the menu.
Yeah, and, thank you.
Treasurer, any thoughts?
No, Mike and I actually came into the house together in 1975, and I knew hardly anyone from anywhere outside of Montgomery County then, and he took such an effort to reach out and be friendly and be helpful and to be a really good colleague and friend. And then through the years, I owe him a great deal and really respect it. And this is a great thing to do. It's one of only many ways in which he's remembered. Even by those of us who aren't as keen on spam, nonetheless, we're keen on Mike Wagner, and I thank you for sharing him with us.
Mr. Wagner, anybody want to be heard?
I'd like to
thank the family before us and just what they gave. And thank you for the commitment of your father and all the servicemen, as well as my father-in-law. He believed in that. He worked very hard for his community. And when Senator DeSetti coached, he coached me on how to reach out to your community to make it a better place, to help the students of our schools. And as I was able, with the senator, I was able to do that. Unfortunately, illness has crept in and stopped that a little bit, but the senator worked hard. He worked so hard the 16 years that he was here, and I appreciate your taking notice of that and honoring him today for this. I think he would so appreciate it. So thank you for your time so much.
Thank you.
I just want to echo that. I am quite grateful that of all the things he's done, he was he really reached out to the people through the airport area when they were having problems, and he wanted to make it right. So he worked hard, and part of this bike thing was just a great idea he had, and I think it is a good way to honor him. And it's close to his community, and a lot of people will enjoy it. So on behalf of my family as well, I do appreciate that this is coming about, and thank you all. Our sons are both working today and weren't able to be here, but they will also thank you as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And I do use it, so.
What's that? She does use it.
Oh, good. Well, the treasurer moves approval. Seconded by the controller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed. The ayes have it. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Well, you all don't feel like you have to stay for the balance of this meeting. Because this is when the good feelings stop. Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, Ed, you want to do a photo with the... yeah, come on over. Mm-hmm. Hey, is Jay still here?
Yes, he's
here. Jay? Yeah, I just heard yes. Thread your way through here.
Yes,
he was. Jay, we don't have a pot, so we'll be okay. Come on up. Okay. Ed? We'll all just squeeze together.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Good seeing you. Thanks for coming to be very well. Thanks for honoring your friend. Okay, the balance of the Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 20 items on the Secretary's agenda, one report of an emergency procurement. We are withdrawing item 19. You have already approved items 8 and 10. Item 17 is the school construction program for next year. We also have the African American Heritage Program here if you would like to hear from Reverend Young on that. But Mr. Lever, Dr. Lever is here on item 17 as well.
Well, I had a question. I know. I had a question, as you know, about the question of the planning requests and why we seem to cut them off at a certain point, not necessarily related to the specific importance of each request, but to the amount of money that seems to be predictable, projectable for construction following a completion of planning. Is that
Is that a fair way of putting it?
That's a very fair way of putting it. We do have to be concerned about the obligation that's being incurred by the state through planning approvals. Every planning approval is a commitment to fund at a future date when the funding request is submitted, assuming the project remains eligible and
right.
Don't have to be recalculated.
And my recollection is the problem is that if, for some reason, there's not sufficient construction funds at a particular point, there does get to be a point where the plans have to be revisited just because of change.
The plans have to be revisited, and we like to, it's not a firm rule, but we like to see a project move into the funding stage within 2 years after planning approval. After that, we start asking questions. We've had some
for practical reasons,
but often because of local fiscal constraints, and we have had projects that go along right. for quite some time because of local fiscal constraints.
So then the question arises, Dr. Lever, about the concern that was brought to us by the school for the deaf, which is not exactly the same as the local budget.
Yes.
But budget issue. And I understand that my impression, at least, is that they requested planning money. They thought they were ready for planning money. It wasn't that people object to the ultimate construction of the sort of buildings that they say are needed at the campus. But this question of whether you ought to authorize planning right now for this and for a dozen others that I gather or something like that
that's
are
correct.
Waiting because of this question of the flux of funds or
that's
the availability
correct.
Of funds. So my request, before we get into any of the specifics here, mm-hmm. And I understand Suzanne has talked to you about this, my request would be that the IAC review the pending planning requests, including these one for the School of the Blind, which seems to be sort of different than a normal, at least a large county with many different competing items, and report back whether there is a way to move these projects along, won't cost any more money, and if so, the pros and cons of how advisable that would be.
We'll be glad to do that. The IC meets on June 12th, and we'll bring this item to them to discuss.
I think if maybe another one of those things that could bear a little more transparency and public attention when they realize we're putting a great amount of money into school construction, but
yes.
there's still some projects ready to go. Children will be well educated, better educated in them, but it's a question of the flow of funds.
It is about the flow of funds. One of the concerns we have is that the promise to fund, the local governments rely on that. And if the state funds are not there for various reasons, sometime in the future, 2 years, 3 years from now, local government may well have moved ahead. Frederick
right.
County at one time had to issue $50 million in local bonds because the state at that time, this is about 10 years ago, was not able to provide the funding.
My recollection is Montgomery County from time to time did that also.
It generally does do projects well in advance, state funding.
But again, the School for the Blind is in a sort of different situation in terms of its funding and local support.
Yes, that's correct. We'll take that to the IAC.
Thank you.
Yes.
Is your exceptional deputy here with you today, Joan Schaefer?
No, she is working hard at maintenance, as a matter of fact, getting those reports done. We find we have to divide and conquer because of the way we're staffed, and so she's not here.
Well, I want to actually, Dr. Lever, thank you and her for the exhaustive work that you do. It's such a great expertise that the two of you together bring to this process, and it's highly complex, as you know, and raises all sorts of very strong passions around the state school construction because it involves our kids. And the governor obviously has made historic investments in the construction of new schools and renovation. Treasurer Kopp, who's talking right now, knows how important school construction is because she, frankly, has dedicated her career to education and financing these investments. So given the stakes, I'd like to just suggest that everybody give Dr. Lever a round of applause.
Thank you.
I do have a couple of questions. Do you have any kind of data as far as how many children will be moved from portable classrooms around Maryland into permanent classrooms as a result of the projects that we're voting for today?
We don't have specific data because we don't receive that kind of information with the request as to exactly how many, say, relocatables will be moved as a result of the construction of an addition or the replacement of a school. What we do have, though, is we look at trends every year. We get the information every year. And what we're seeing is that for the last 4 years, there's been an average decrease of 108 relocatable units every year. Of course, the reasons are complex. Some of that could be because of demographic shifts, change of educational program, as well as construction that provides permanent facilities in place of the relocatables. But with that, we calculate that the equivalent capacity of 108 classrooms is about 2,500 student seats at 23 per classroom. So presumably those students are moving into permanent facilities as a result, partly of a school construction program. But we can provide more exact information. We'd have to actually go to the LEAs and ask for it, if you like.
Excellent. And on a separate subject, can you tell us how many schools in Baltimore City and Baltimore County will receive air conditioning in the classrooms as a result of this year's program and the percentage of schools that still lack air conditioning in those two jurisdictions after this round of projects is complete?
In Baltimore City, there are 10 air conditioning projects. Three of those are in schools that do not currently have air conditioning, so they're bringing in air conditioning for the first time. And once this round of projects is completed, the percentage of schools without air conditioning will be 42%. That's down from 44%. Okay. And in Baltimore County, there are 10 air conditioning projects, and those also include major renovations and new construction. Seven of those are in schools that do not currently have air conditioning, and that will bring the percentage of schools that don't have air conditioning down to 33% in Baltimore County from 37.
Excellent. And then just finally, I know you don't like to give your personal opinions, but as you look down the list of the projects that we're voting for today, are there any projects that jump off the page as just barely missed the cut and perhaps caught your eye as particularly meritorious or worthy but not receiving funding? And if you could maybe give me a little sense of any of those that we might keep an eye out for next year.
If it was an eligible project and missed the cut, it was because of fiscal constraints. Simply we reached the limit of what we had available to us. Some projects missed the cut. They're still what we would call a C project rather than a B project. It could be some minor technical issue that wasn't quite completed in time. There are projects, for instance, there are two projects in Baltimore County that we're very interested in, Relay Elementary School in the southwest area, the Catonsville area, and Lock Raven Elementary School in the south central area. And the reason they weren't recommended for funding is that they don't have design. The designs haven't moved forward. So there really is no assurance that they would spend their funds if they were allocated in FY15. Those funds would be spent better elsewhere. Harford County, Joppatown High School was fiscal constraints. That's a limited renovation. Montgomery County is an area of particular concern because, as the treasurer said, they move forward with projects, and then state funding often follows behind. And they do a very good job of stratifying their projects. But it is critical that their top priority projects get funded because otherwise they go into a PAYGO-only situation. They can't use tax exempt bond proceeds to reimburse them. And we have six projects that we didn't have funds for this year that were in that top tier. If they're submitted next year, as I expect they will be the top priorities, and they need to be funded because otherwise they will go into a PAYGO situation. Mm-hmm. That's a total of about $19.2 million in state funding, which I think is very manageable within the totals that we have traditionally been able to provide from Montgomery County. But there are also other projects further down the list that will be added to that list of the critical projects. Prince George's were very interested in their special education initiative. They have an initiative to close all but one special education center and convert those special education centers into comprehensive elementary schools. And there are five projects that fall into that range. One of those would be a renovated special center. The others would become elementary schools. And in Baltimore City, Hollabird Pre-K to 8 and Graceland Park O'Donnell Heights will move forward in the CIP. They are companions to the projects that are being funded through the Stadium Authority funds, and they are critical to the revitalization of the southeast area of Baltimore. So they've been developed in conjunction with the City Planning Department as part of an overall plan for that area. So those are the projects that are currently in the CIP that we're looking forward to next year.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Are there any other questions? We are seeking approval of the $325.3 million CIP.
Do I have to answer a question? Approval. Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. How about the balance of the Secretary's agenda? That was item what?
That was item 17.
Item 17 is the it had been called by the Comptroller's question.
Is Reverend Young here? Or the Mount Zion AME Church. Okay, well, the item is in order for the African American Heritage Program, so it will be fine. The rest of the agenda is probably pretty straightforward.
Mr. Comptroller?
Yes, item 14.
Morgan University. I don't know if Mr. Worthley is here or who's here from, or is Miss Whitaker? Yeah, hi there. All right, this is the dining contract for Morgan State University.
Good morning. My name is Lois Whitaker. I'm with Morgan State University. I have with me Constantine Hill, who is the project coordinator for this RFP, and Vanetta McCullough, who is the director of Business Auxiliary Services, responsible for managing the contract. They are here to answer any questions that you all may have with regards to the contract.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. So I do have a couple of questions, because it's a rather large contract when you include the option years. We're talking $77.8 million, so that's almost $80 million. What concerns me is that there apparently Thompson, the vendor that we are being asked to award the contract to, was the only vendor to submit a proposal that was deemed acceptable. So here we have a nearly $80 million contract, and which is considerable magnitude, and we're awarding it to someone in the absence of actual bid competition. And I guess I have a couple of questions that flow from that. Number one, who is the incumbent vendor?
Thompson's is the incumbent vendor.
Thompson, okay.
Yes.
So, according to my background notes, there were three proposals received. One was disqualified due to MBE deficiencies, and the other, I quote, was disqualified, did not meet the minimum technical qualifications to have the financial proposal reviewed. How, if I could ask, I'm not sure you have this information, but had they been allowed to compete for the contract, how would their proposals compare with the $77.8 million winning bid?
Okay, we do not have the financial information for that particular proposal, because once the technicals have been evaluated by the committee and they have not reached the 55-point minimum, which we submitted, it was a 55-point minimum, then there were no financials submitted to the committee.
I have another question on that, but let me just address this MBE component of the first vendor that was disqualified.
Sure.
Why was it fatally deficient?
It was deficient because we had a goal set for this project for 40%, and the that vendor did not submit a 40%, nor did they submit for a waiver for that.
What did they submit?
It was 35%.
35%?
Yes, 35%. and the PRG and the university's MBE liaison is the one that actually reviews those qualifications to see if they are able to move forward. And not only did they not meet the 40%, but they did not meet the recommended MBEs that were asked for in that in their submission.
What does that mean?
Well, we asked for actually, let me flip to this. Just a minute.
Sub-goals?
Yes, the sub-goals. The sub-goals.
Okay.
Yes, the sub-goals. The actual sub-goals that we asked for this project was it was 40%, with 7% African-American, 4% Asian, and 12% woman-owned. They actually submitted sub-goals of Hispanic-American of 12%, woman-owned of 8%, and woman-owned of 15%. So they did not address the Asian-owned at all, and they did not request a waiver.
If I could, Madam Treasurer, unless you have other questions, I find this to be kind of remarkable because my recollection of most of the university system's contracts are that MBE goals are in the 20%, maybe 25%. So 40 strikes me as, it sticks out in my mind. I don't know whether Mr. Sterling or Mr. Evans are here.
Actually, they are not here. They're not? The university system in Morgan,
is there anyone here that can help me? Am I far off that the system generally is around?
Mr. Farley is here, but I don't know. Unfortunately, Mr. Sterling is ill this morning, and he just called in at 6 a.m. to see if it's okay. So they do have somebody here to represent the university items, but I don't know if the person will be able to.
I think Ms. Hurley would like
well,
to.
What are the, I guess the question is, what within the university system are typical MBE goals that are established in these kinds of hospitality service contracts? So my recollection is it's 20 to 25% is customary.
I think that your recollection would be correct that a dining service contract, typically the goals are lower, but they can vary,
and goals should vary depending on the scope of services that are involved in each specific contract. With this particular contract, the university determined that there were a number of different subcontractable opportunities, and thus the 40% goal. What we, certainly everyone recognizes that the statewide goal is 29%. Agencies are supposed to review their procurements in light of that goal, in light of trying to attempt to meet that goal with their annual spend. And so recognizing that some goals will be rather low or have no goal at all, then we certainly see the reasonableness of where there are significant opportunities that you would sometimes see a goal as high as 40%, because on balance, when you average everything together, you would still hope to meet that 29%. That's going to require you agencies sometimes going above 29% because they will have, as I said, projects with the lower goal. So in this instance, again, you know, I don't know the specific details of this particular procurement, but certainly when we spoke to the agency, they determined that there were significant subcontracting opportunities here to warrant the 40% goal.
Okay. Thank you for giving me that. Do you happen to recall the UMES hospitality contract we approved recently and what the MBE goal was for that campus? Anybody?
Off the top of my head, I would say I don't. It may have been rather low because, like I said, a lot of dining services contracts are low. I'll see it. I could certainly research that.
Great. Yeah. Well, I think my point here is that I don't mind high MBE goals. I'm all for that. But if it ends up with the exclusion of people that would provide some competitive
bids on the financials, boy, that does concern me, especially when you get an incumbent that is, in effect, being awarded a single bid contract here for nearly $80 million. I don't know. Doesn't that strike you folks as an valid perception? I'm not saying anything is wrong, but it certainly looks as if the incumbent was selected by removing some of the competition, and that just well, let me go back to the technical qualifications. You mentioned that someone was eliminated, one of the three was eliminated. Isn't that the whole point of these competitive bids, that you accept something that may have some technical low scores, but then you look and you have some kind of a balance between the financials and the technicals, and that's how you, I mean, how can you make a determination that a bid should not even be looked at based on, you see what I'm talking about?
Yes. In this particular case, based on the RFP, we had seven criteria that were set aside. And the highest was the one that dealt with the program area. Now, we submitted it on email in Marketplace, and over 90 people were sent this RFP. But only a small number, four or five, responded back to the RFP. So we did have competitive bid by placing it on eMarl and Marketplace based on the budget threshold of being over $25,000. When we looked at the MBE, there are five MBEs who have been identified with their specific percentage of what they would do to be able to help with the service along with Thompson Hospitality. So in answer to your question, we did send it out to be competitively bid. Unfortunately, not a lot of people applied. And when we looked at the vendor that was not disqualified, but did not advance, their scoring was significantly lower with regards to what they were able to provide. Thompson's scoring was at 18. The other vendor's scoring was at 12. We were looking at services being provided on the north end of the campus where there are no food services or anything like that. And Thompson was able to provide Morgan with a solution to handle that. Our new building, Cebus, which is the architectural building, is there, and the Schaefer Engineering Building is there. And we have no way of providing food or anything like that. The other company could not provide that kind of service on a daily basis. In addition, the other company could not use our Bear card, which is a single source where students can go and pay for the services there, nor did they accept credit. So that helped to sway us in terms of the scoring for that particular vendor.
I can see that completely. Okay. My concern is, why weren't they allowed to bid? Where's the fatal defect in an MBE applicant who comes in and says, yeah, I didn't meet the 40%, but I'm at 35%. I mean, at least you ought to open up the bid and take a look and see what the finances are. And then secondly, on this other issue of the technically deficient, I mean, I thought that was that's the point of having competitive bids. Some people are great at technical and not so good and very expensive, so they get bumped out. Some people are bad, some people are bad and technical.
I would also like to...
I mean, isn't that the whole competitive procurement process we open up the bids?
It is. What we also did, we had an oral presentation for the companies to come in to also give us a overview of their company and what they could provide, and also answer any of the questions that the committee may have had to kind of help them with some understanding, help them decide whether, you know, they could provide the service, even though they didn't put it technically in the proposal, through their oral, and be able to give some explanation. And even in that, the answers that they gave were not sufficient for the university, for the committee, to think that they could provide the service that was needed to the level that we need. Going back to speaking on what Ms. Whitaker was just saying was there were several things that played effect on how the score was actually done. The scoring was done. Once the orals were actually done, once the committee, the companies came in and gave their orals, it was very clear to the committee, which was comprised of not only the university staff, but university students that were, that the Board of Regents asked that there be students on this committee, because the students, they are who we're serving, and they know a lot of what we need on the university campus just by being able to communicate with the staff. And so when those presentations were done and we came to a conclusion of the scoring, we still found them to be deficient in what they could provide as far as service at a specific side of campus. They could not guarantee us, which was proposed, a food truck. They could not guarantee that the university would have a food truck and service to be able to provide students in that end of campus with the service that's needed. To reiterate, they would not accept the university bear card. They also would not be able to use, the students would not be able to use their flex dollars on campus. These are mechanisms that keep the students on campus from having to carry cash. So that played a part in the scoring process. So
can I?
Yes.
Just so I'm trying to still understand. Three bids came in.
Yes.
One of which did not meet 40%, and the other two did.
Right.
Right.
That's correct.
And the one that didn't meet 40% said 35, which to me is implicitly asking for a waiver for 5, but they didn't explicitly ask for a waiver for 5. Is that the process when they come in and they say we can make 35? They don't ask you to waive 35. It means they're just not considered.
We unfortunately have several different, well, two different strategies in how we have dealt with this. We have some forms where we have found that it is a problem where vendors will forget to ask for a waiver, having not met the goal, and one agency, in particular Department of Transportation, who administers the DBE program, has adjusted its form so that waivers are more implicit when vendors don't meet the goal. But the rest of the state, it's very clear that you have to, it says on the forms, you either have to check the box saying you met the goal or that you didn't meet the goal and you're requesting a waiver. And the failure to request a waiver.
That sounds familiar from another. Why don't we just say, do we meet 40? Yes or no? If not, how much do you want a waiver for? 100%? 5? What?
Well, I think you make a good point, and I think it's why the Department of Transportation changed their form so they wouldn't have to throw vendors out, simply because they failed to check the box requesting a waiver, and at least they could be evaluated for whether they made a good faith effort to meet the goal and under the waiver. But unfortunately,
35 out of 40 is not bad. But so there's that apparently irredeemable error of not asking to waive for 5%, though you say you'll meet 35. And then this other one, so that was out from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one, met the 40%, but when you looked at what you needed, it wasn't able to perform some of the things that you thought were essential, like serving the North Campus and using the Bayer Card. Yeah. So it never reached the threshold level of technical points to then lead to opening
the finances.
And was that laid out in the RFP that they have to serve the North Campus and the...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Both vendors provided, they provided a solution. The one solution was that the vendor, Thompson, that we're proposing to award to, would provide service via a Thompson's vehicle, a mobile unit, that would be in the north location all the time, daily, a dedicated unit to be there daily. The solution for the other vendor was that they would contact a service in the city of Baltimore that may be able to provide service on some days. We would not know who was going to show up, on which days they were going to show up, what type of food they were serving, if they were serving just a taco truck or if it was going to be a breakfast truck. They could not tell us that. Only thing they said that, well, we have a consortium where we can contact these groups of individuals and ask if they could provide service to you for a day, a week, or whatever. That's not what we were looking for. It was clearly specified that we were looking for service for the north end of campus on a daily basis. And also the Bayer Card played a major piece in that. That was also in the proposal that we needed them to be able to accept that as part of the service. And there are certain reasons for that. The north end of campus is kind of on the end of campus where there's not a whole lot of traffic going on. We don't want students down there carrying cash if they don't have to. So, you know, so therefore, you know, not having to carry cash.
And this was all clear in the RFP.
Yes, yes, ma'am.
That again, the 35 to 40, I find really...
Well, if I could just reclaim my time, I think the whole thing is bad. I mean, I really think the perception here is you have an incumbent vendor, you're giving a $77.8 million award, and two of the three applicants are disqualified out of hand, admittedly for apparently legitimate reasons. All I'm saying is, that's the whole point of the procurement process. If there are three bids out of whatever it was that you mailed to, take them, open them up, look at them, see whether there's any rationale that would argue that you know, you should perhaps have a different viewpoint. As it looks to me right now, you disqualified them, and you know there had been a decision made ahead of time to give it to the incumbent. That could be a perception. But let me switch subjects here just for a little bit, because you mentioned the students who were on the review panel. Did anybody tell the students about the fact that when Towson University did this exact same kind of procurement a year ago, that the private sector company, I think it's called Compass Group, not Thompson, but Compass Group, that won the contract, in addition to being awarded the contract, gave Towson capital investments of $5.2 million, gave a restricted gift of $500,000, this is from the company, to the new Unitas Stadium. They gave an annual unrestricted gift of $50,000 a year. To the annual capital campaign fund. They gave an in-kind catering fund having an annual value of $60,000. $18,000 annual cash contribution for student life. $2,500 annual in-kind contribution to the Student Government Association. All I'm saying is the list goes on, where, and you often see these in these campus dining service contracts, there's a whole host of commitments that accompany them. I assume you've got a whole list ready for me to tell me that Thompson is going to like
like this. And frankly, I think a couple of weeks ago I mentioned the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, which Thompson won the contract for in a competitive bid. They also had a whole host of accompanying contributions to UMES. Do you guys have that?
Thompson has proposed to give a scholarship in the amount of $25,000 annually to the university. The university, our experience has been as it relates to capital enhancements that we have found it to be much more feasible for. What we find is the norm is that there is some kind of repayment schedule, and we have found it more feasible at the university to use university funds for those kinds of capital investments rather than using the contractor's contributions. And so in this particular procurement, we worked long and hard from the technical side of the house with representatives throughout the university, and that included three students. We had faculty persons, staff persons, a total of nine persons on the committee. And one of the ground rules was that we were to evaluate the RFPs, evaluate the proposals against the RFP. And we made it real clear that if companies were offering contributions, it was going to be difficult to evaluate because the technical committee, if you will, did not deal with finances at all. We just dealt with the program aspect of the RFP. And so in that regard, we wanted to make certain that we were evaluating apples to apples, and that any financial kinds of contributions and support would be a part of the financial
proposals. That's great. I don't mean to interrupt, but you're not comparing apples to apples. You're comparing apples to nothing, because there's only one bid.
No,
and that's the problem here.
Right.
And, I respect all of the explanations that I've heard, but I think this particular contract, which is because of the magnitude of it, I didn't have this opinion before I walked in, but I'm voting against it because I think this is just not right given the amount of public dollars that are associated here and the lack of any kind. I mean, how can you negotiate with the private company on any sweeteners that every other campus apparently negotiates with on a regular basis? And you guys just say, oh, well, we don't do that, I guess, because it wasn't in the RP. I mean, did you hear that list of what I read off about Towson? And what about UMES? Does anybody here remember what UMES got? I mean, they
didn't actually say. They did have the I have it in front of them. I'm not sure. They did get in-kind renovations.
Yes, and I'm saying that that's just a matter of negotiation, and you guys can't negotiate because there's only one bid. I don't know. I don't mean to be harsh, and I don't mean to get hot under the collar, but I think this is this should be sent back and rebid, and there should be some competition. Right now, we have no idea. The first question I asked was, "What were the other the financials? What did those two people bid?" Exactly.
Controller, if they don't advance, I truly heard what you said in terms of the competition, but we can't make people apply. If, like Towson, you talked about Compass or whatever that company was, they had an opportunity to submit a proposal as well as any other company. So, our hands are sort of tied if, in fact, you don't submit a proposal. Now, with regards to the proposals that you that were submitted, we hear what you're saying in terms of the competition, but when we look at and I don't want to rehash this, but we're following the RFP that was written. Now, maybe we need to go back in and look at that RFP and restructure it in a different way.
So, 10-year, $80 million contract, no competition. Incumbent wins.
opponents disqualified or other bidders. It's not matter. Right. It's you should go back. Year. You, in my humble opinion, should go back and rebid this.
Okay.
Can I just say, I think it's a 5-year contract,
right,
actually.
Years.
5-year base
yes.
contract. And there was competition. With, there was not price competition. There was competition to the state, to the stage of technical capacity. And I heard what you said about the two. I didn't read the RFP, but I have to trust you that it was laid out in the RFP
yeah,
that the
yes.
North Campus would be served in a certain way and that the students' food card would be
used.
So I think there was competition that the second firm simply didn't make it through the technical competition to a level to be I assume you would say they couldn't provide the services that were needed regardless of unless they
it was not as strong of a proposal.
I mean I guess in practical terms if their bid was so terribly low you could get somebody else to do just the North Campus in another contract. I mean completely redo that. But the other thing, you were following procedures that other agencies follow, I gather. I don't understand why they don't all follow the procedure that transportation does, however.
Well, and now, quite frankly, this is not a situation that arises often in most of the state governments. It's something that happened more frequently at MDOT because they have certain counting rules that led to contractors miscalculating the percentage. Now that the concerns have been raised, and certainly we have this situation, we'll go back and change the form so that
like
it's consistent across all agencies.
It's an administrative hurdle to go through.
And Secretary Cobb, we're following the MBE certified utilization and fair solicitation affidavit that we've gotten from the Minority Business Office.
Okay? Oh, I don't doubt that.
And I understand.
You know, what I'm saying is that when you ask for 40, which is high, somebody puts in 35, there ought to be a way to either go back and say, you mean you want to waive 5? And they say, yes, that's what we mean. You know, I mean, if you don't say I want to waive 5, then you don't count. I mean, that does not rise to a level of, I think so. But that's what I gather the process calls for.
It comes down to the procurement law. The procurement law says, is this a minor irregularity? Okay. We viewed it not being a minor irregularity.
All I'm saying is the form could change to make it clearer for people that they are not, when they say 35, implicitly saying, and we don't mean 40. They say 35 and therefore, one line maybe, 35 and therefore not, we ask for a waiver of everything up to 40 or something. But at any rate, I'm prepared to support this.
Thank you.
Am I saying something wrong?
What would be the harm in rebidding it, going back and doing this?
The existing contract expires May 30th.
You have a big summer school?
Well, that's why we...
When we had the pre-bid, we had 26 individuals to show up representing 6 different companies. And those individuals, they all were given the outline of what was to happen with the MBE if they were not able to provide the MBE goal. They were all given the rules of bidding, actually.
Campus tour.
And they were given a campus tour. Several of the vendors came back at minimum of 3 times to kind of make sure that they were clear on what they needed to provide to the university. So even out of those 6 vendors that showed up for the pre-bid, you know, we felt that ample time was allotted for them to be
able. And the reason they were disqualified was why?
Pardon me?
And why were the others all disqualified?
Well, the others just didn't submit.
Okay. How many did and were disqualified?
Well, we had 3 vendors to submit.
Uh-huh.
One was an MBE issue. The one score was low on the technical. and the others who are moved forward to have their financials reviewed.
To answer your question, Governor, what would be the worst thing? We would have to go on, and I'm not sure that that would be the worst, a month-to-month contract with the existing vendor if we rebid it, okay, since the contract is ending at the end of the month.
I'm reminded that Towson only had one as well, huh?
Towson had only one bid. What they said a year ago this time, in May of 2013, Towson said four firms attended the pre-proposal conference. Only one offer submitted a proposal. Inquirers of non-responding firms disclosed that several institutions in the region were soliciting proposals from the industry simultaneously. The university determined that other prospective offers had reasonable opportunity to respond and therefore recommends only one bid.
All right. Treasurer moves approval. Governor seconds.
If I could just explain my no vote.
Okay. And, all in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? Sure. No vote.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hang on, because I'm explaining my vote. I believe this is a failed procurement. And it is a 10-year contract for almost $80 million. Yes, 5 years, but it has 5 one-year options added on. The vendor, the competition, as far as I'm concerned, was arbitrarily disqualified. The deal, compared to the Towson deal, is far inferior. I mean, you obviously left millions of dollars of contributions from the vendor on the table. I believe that the process, from my standpoint, appears to be biased towards the incumbent. And when you do something like that, it does not serve the taxpayers. So I would suggest that you do the right thing and, despite the vote, extend the current contract, rebid the whole project, come back with some real bid competition and a transparent scoring system that serves as the basis for your decision. Because this stinks, period. Yep, this is just handed the big bow tied around it to the incumbent. So hats off to Thompson. They whatever they did worked. But this is not a good deal for the taxpayers. Thank you, Governor. No vote.
Okay, Comptroller votes no. How about any other issues on the Secretary's agenda?
Can I just add something just for the university people who are here? I hear what the Comptroller says, and I remember the ones we've approved in the past. And this is not your contract. I understand that when you renew food facilities, there often is a need to make physical improvements, to make changes that help you deliver your services better, and I think that that's totally appropriate. I have to tell you that I've been troubled the last few times when we get to the financials and all of a sudden competitors start throwing in things that may or may not be directly related to improving the food service. I'm not sure. I think it's great they want to support the university. There are ways to support the university. But I would hate to have people think that somehow it's that you got to put in little extraneous add-ons not totally related to the contract to get a contract. And I just have to say I should have spoken out more strongly when we saw this before, and I didn't. But I just don't think it's the way Maryland should be doing business.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
But if we hate it for food, sir, that's a different issue.
Yeah, no, but we would hate to think that something was fixed for one of the applicants.
Absolutely.
Because of something that is out of the ordinary, like this looks.
Yeah.
This looks like it was fixed for the incumbent, and I just can't
always
believe we're moving ahead with
is
this.
The only bidder, I wonder about that.
Yeah, and the others are arbitrarily. You know, it's like me
but
running for election.
Bitter, yeah.
Okay, I'm on the ballot, and I figure out some way to bump off the opponent that I might have because of a technical problem.
gee, that'd take me a quick minute to make up my mind. But the people don't benefit from that. Community loses. Because then I'm all by myself. Mm-hmm. That's not the way this system works, and I really am concerned that Morgan, of all places, has put itself in this position. And I've made my statement, but this is not right, and I hope that you correct it yourself voluntarily. Go back and say to Thompson, you know what? We should have had competition. We're going to redo it. You're the incumbent. It's nothing for them to extend the contract for another 6 months and get some competition. Come back to us. And I would be delighted if there was competition with both technical and financial scores like the system is intended to produce to go along with whatever your decision is. But not like this.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any other issues on the balance of the Secretary's agenda?
Jasmine, what are we looking at?
So what I want is the TBA.
Secretary's agenda, Mr. Comptroller, no?
No.
Okay, Comptroller moves approval of the balance of the Secretary's agenda, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. Real property.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer, Emily Wilson with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We have 8 items on our agenda today. Be happy to try to answer any questions.
Any questions? Hearing none, Comptroller moves approval. Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The
ayes
have it.
Thank you. Department of Budget and Management.
Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, good morning. There are 8 items on the Department of Budget Management's agenda for today. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Yeah. I have a question on number 2, doing something my colleagues do. I don't usually. I actually have no question on number 2, but I have a question for DHMH. You learn. Mr. Kim, we've been reading recently about the MERS virus emerging in the United States now, come from Saudi Arabia, presumably by a person who was on an airplane. And the latest thing was in the paper that in a hospital in the South, the person who was infected had to wait around for several hours in an emergency room with a lot of people around them, thereby potentially infecting those people with a very serious virus, somewhat akin to the SARS virus of several years ago. And I remember when we went through the concerns about SARS and about Ebola, actually, there was a whole regime across the state that involved both the public hospitals, the doctors, pharmacies, to try to get early warning, red flags, et cetera, for an invasion if something that was communicable dangerous disease, perhaps without even great antibiotic treatments available, were coming. But then we've had a quiet period, a relatively quiet period, as I understand it, although maybe I've been misled. And I just want to know if we're in shape now to jump on something, if we've got the network and what we plan to do when things like this come in. Obviously, just to play my same old string again, with a changing climate and the impact of climate changes on animals, plants, et cetera, and our biota, we're going to be seeing more of these, I think. So what do we do? And you don't have to have a huge briefing here. Just know I would like to hear back, and I assume my colleagues would at some point, about how Maryland is prepared.
Sure. I appreciate the question, Madam Treasurer. As far as Middle East Respiratory Syndrome is concerned, There have been no cases reported in the state of Maryland. The Secretary and our Office of Emergency Response has been in touch with all hospitals and doctors throughout the state since 2013 regarding MERS itself. Now, as far as when and if a case is identified in the system, that will trigger a whole series of protocols as it relates to communication to all Marylanders. And even prior to an event or a case being identified, the department will have a series of communications. The details of which I'm happy to inform the Secretary will be able to provide, you know, to you now, in much more detail.
That there be an early warning system in place. I think that there is.
The details of which we will be happy to provide to you and the rest of the board members. I'm sure the Secretary will be happy to engage in a conversation about the best ways to inform the public of MERS or any future communicable disease.
Okay. I look forward to hearing more.
Sure.
Thank you. These things move quickly, or they seem to go in quietus for quite a time, and you don't know which.
Okay. Are we moving now to the real property, mm-hmm. right?
So this wasn't DBM agenda. This, the treasurer just had a question for.
Okay. Did we approve DBM? Or?
No. Okay. The treasurer just asked a question.
Treasurer moves approval of the Department of Budget Management agenda. Seconded by the controller. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. The ayes have it. We now move to.
University System of
Maryland. University System of Maryland.
John Farley is here. The University System has 10 items today.
Good morning. I'm John Farley, Assistant Vice President at the University of Maryland College Park, standing in for Jim Sterling, who's sick, unfortunately, for me. So I believe we have 10 items for your consideration. Do you all have any questions that I may attempt to respond to?
Okay. Any questions? No? Controller moves approval. Seconded by the treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on now to the Department of Information Technology.
Good morning. I'm Greg Urban with the Department of Information Technology. Mr. Governor, Madam Treasurer, Ms. Comptroller, I have 7 items on the agenda. Happy to answer any questions for you.
Any questions?
Move approval.
Controller moves approval. Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it.
Thank you.
On now to the Department of Transportation.
Good morning again. For the record, Jim Smith representing MDOT. We have 19 items for your consideration as item 7AE has been withdrawn. Be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions? Department of Transportation. Treasurer moves approval. Seconded by the controller. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on now to the Department of General Services.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. I'm Bart Thomas, Deputy Secretary. I'm filling in for Secretary Collins, who's out doing great service today. The department has 29 items, including one supplemental on our agenda. We are withdrawing item 29. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have at this time.
Any questions? Controller moves approval. Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. And that concludes our agenda. Thank you all very much.